Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. We had a little scheduling snafu, and so we do not have Zach Lynn from Jimmy World with us today, but we do have a great show for you in store. One of the things you noticed if you go to any sort of Protestant evangelical church in America is the centerpiece of the room is always a podium, a lectern, or maybe just a music stand. And architecture speaks to us. If you step into one of these churches, you'll see that the most important aspect of church, according to our architecture, is the spoken word. Which is kind of weird because you don't find anywhere else in our culture, for the most part, a time in which people would gather together to sit down and listen to someone talk for 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes uninterrupted. You rarely find that. Now, in the early days of the Bible, when we didn't even have the Hebrew scriptures written down, the stories that became our Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible were passed down orally. People would tell the stories to their friends, their family, and that's how these stories of faith got passed down. You fast forward hundreds of years and you get to when the New Testament was written, and you had Paul writing letters to churches, and he didn't email these letters, but he wrote them, and then someone would read them aloud to the entire congregation, and that's how people learn the stories of faith through hundreds of years. People reading to them, they would just listen. Until around 1500, when the printing press was invented by our friends in Gutenberg, and that led into a new stage of world history. Modernity, the Reformation, all came out of the printing press's invention, or connected to the printing press's invention. And so now you have people who can read at home, they don't listen as much, and you fast forward to today, and we don't listen to anything. If you try to watch a YouTube video in which you have to watch a 15-second commercial to watch the YouTube video, most people will open a second screen up just so they don't have to wait 15 seconds to watch a commercial. And so the question is, you go to church and the centerpiece is someone talking to you, which is something that's so out of our normal everyday life. I wonder, what is the closest thing to that? And I think the closest thing to that in our culture is stand-up comedy. Which is a weird thing for a preacher to think about as that being the closest other medium in which someone has an art similar to theirs, but it's probably the only other time where people sit down and listen to someone talk uninterrupted for 45 minutes to an hour. Only other place. And so what we're doing today is I brought in two of my good preacher friends, Jonathan Stormont from Abilene, Texas, and Wade Hodges from Dallas, Texas, to join me to talk a little bit about the intersection of the art of preaching and stand-up comedy. So welcome to the show, Jonathan and Wade.
Thanks, Luke.
Thank you.
I'm excited to have you guys here. And you guys are both good preachers. And so I've got to admit, there have been times where I heard both of you preach, and I thought, man, that was good. And so that next Sunday, I was up on stage in my church, and I was straight up Mark Driscolling you guys, because I think both of you are great preachers, and I think this will be a great conversation about preaching with you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah,
looking forward to it.
Well, you're welcome. All right, so first of all, my premise that the closest medium to preaching that is prevalent in our culture is stand-up comedy. What do you guys think about that comparison?
When I was in college, my one of the preaching teachers that I had actually made that point, said that stand-up comedians are the place to learn rhetoric today. The way they do transitions, the way that they're so tight on word choice. I think you're right. I never thought of it before, but there's not a lot of places in society where people actually sit down and a large audience listens to one person talk for that long a time. So yeah, I do think there's quite a bit of overlap.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you agree so we can do the rest of this podcast. If not, we'd have to kick you off.
It was like a yes, no question, right?
Yeah. I mean, you pretty much had to say yes, or I would have ended the call right now. And then we would have had a 4-minute podcast, but since you said yes, let's continue. Now, first of all, before we talk about the commonalities, there are obviously some differences. And the first one is a preacher gets up every week and talks to the same group of people, whereas a comedian gets up and talks to different groups of people giving the same talk basically for an entire year or longer with the same material. So let me ask you this question. If you had the ability to say the same message for a year, how good do you think that would be?
How good would the message be, or how good would it be to only have to write one sermon a year?
Both.
I actually had a couple of years where I was traveling and speaking, and I wasn't doing the same message over and over again, but I had a handful of messages that I did multiple times, and there was one of them in there that was my favorite message. I probably have preached that message 25, 30 times at this point. And it is a lot of fun, and it's wonderful because every time you preach it, it gets tighter. You find new stuff in there, new jokes or new nuances or ways to make a point. And I do think it gets better every time I preach it. So the idea of a comedian who's done the same routine hundreds of times, by the time we see them on TV, they have worked that routine over hundreds of times. And I can see why it is so good and so tight and so sharp. What we never see is the first two or three times when they do it, mm-hmm. when it resembles more of our regular sermons, where they don't know if it's going to be funny or not. They don't know what points are going to work or not.
Yeah,
that is one of the things that I've appreciated about paying attention to comedians is the amount of risk that doing a set takes. And it feels like there's quite a bit of overlap between the risk that preachers take every week or you know, maybe should, because every Sunday we don't know if something's going to work, if a joke is going to fall flat, or if it's going to really connect with people, or if the point or message that we're trying to communicate is going to be as important to them as it hopefully is to us. So, I mean, there is that. I think one of the differences is even in the language we use about comedy, we talk about lighthearted, or you know, it's the very nature of humor is to not take something seriously. And for millennial generations and younger people, I mean, that's satire is really helpful. It's in the Bible. You've got the whole book of Jonah that is kind of like the Daily Show of the Old Testament. But the interesting thing about this for me is, you know, the word glory means heavy. And so, I mean, there's a gravity to the kind of story of the gospel and the weight of the presence of God. And how do you communicate about that, something that's heavy, in a light way? And I think you should, and that humor is important in sermons. It's important to be, you know, engaging. But there is a tension between, I think what a comedian's win is pretty different than what a week in and week out preacher, or what a win would be for them.
Yeah. And so the win for the comedian is just to get the laugh. And then the win for the preacher is for that to be, you know, considered a good sermon. And obviously getting more laughs helps people feel like it's a better sermon, but it's not the ultimate end.
Yeah.
I also think when a comedian is on stage trying something out, he or she knows that if it doesn't work, I get another shot at this. I can work on this and make it better.
Yeah.
Most of the time when we do our sermons, we get one shot at. Maybe you preach it multiple times in a Sunday, but you don't get to go back and say, all right, I get to deliver this to a different audience. I totally blew that. I can rewrite it and make it better next time. Yeah. It is one shot. And I do two services on Sunday. Usually if something doesn't go well in first, I can take it out and not do it again, but I don't have a lot of time to totally rework it. So to me, that's sometimes what's frustrating about preaching versus working on a routine is, man, it didn't work, but I don't get a chance to go back and fix it. And that'll actually haunt me throughout the week because it's this unfixable mistake that I don't get to redeem.
Yeah. I heard Seinfeld in his documentary Comedian talk about the process of developing a new stand-up, which is obviously the whole story of the documentary Comedian. But it said it took him 3 months to develop 20 minutes worth of material.
Yeah.
3 months. That, I mean, if you're a preacher, in 3 months you've prepared 12 talks, and so you're looking at, you know, 3 hours of material, 3.5 hours of material, and he's only done 20 minutes.
Right. And here's where I think it is hard for a preacher living in a stand-up comedian culture, that sometimes I feel a pressure that because listeners have heard great comedians like that, there is a bit of a pressure to, okay, I know you're not going to do 30 minutes of pure comedy, but I want you to have some funny bits. I want you to keep my attention. I want you to be entertaining.
Yep.
And so they compare the preacher they're hearing on Sunday to whoever they heard on Letterman on Friday night. And the truth is, they've had months to get it right. We got one shot, and yet they still want us to be as engaging and funny and entertaining as the comedian they see on TV.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely have that going for them. On the other hand, we have something going for us, is that when a comedian gets up, they have no relationship with their audience.
Mm.
We, on the other hand, we know our audience, and then sometimes there are preachers who've been at the same place for, you know, 10 years. And I'm sure you guys have seen this too, but, you know, I've been in a place where there's a guy who's been there for a long time, and as he's telling a joke, you can see and feel people in the audience are about to laugh just because they've been trained that this is when he's going to tell a joke, this is what's coming, and they're just waiting for the punchline in which they're already ready to laugh because there has been some sort of relationship developed over all the years. Whereas a comedian, each audience is a completely different monster, especially when they're doing like the small clubs and the small venues in which, you know, you have 50 people in a room and two or three people can completely change the experience.
Right. And a lot of times comedians are performing in front of people who have had too much to drink, which
yes.
which might still be true for some preachers.
I was going to say, I think I've preached at those audiences as well. You know, one of the things that I think is important to talk about in this podcast, especially for people who are ever going to speak on behalf of God in any kind of way, is what, you know, Wade, you just mentioned that there's a pressure that you feel from people who are just used to seeing professional comedians. Well, what you're actually doing there is kind of thinking like a missionary, because, you know, this is one of the dominant forms of communication. And I think one of the things about the gospel is that it has to be translated. And so I think you've got to at least, if this isn't your particular gift, then don't try to be somebody that you're not or whatever. But when I work with people who want to become preachers, this is one of the things I tend to harp on quite a bit, because it's something that's important to me in preparing a sermon. Luke, we were on staff together at a church for a long time, and there was a couple of people at the Hills that were funny people, just really funny. And if I had a story that I wanted to tell in a sermon, every week I would get them in the room and tell the story and then let them say stuff, whatever came to their mind, and make it funnier.
Yeah.
And I do that every week at Highland. I have some friends that I think are funny, and, you know, I tell them a story, and they'll throw in a couple of, like, you could say this here, and most of the time I do, and most of the time it works. And I say that because I take this part of it seriously.
Yep.
You know, there's a difference between amusement and entertainment, because amusement is like without muse or without like inspiration, really. It's basically kind of slack-jawed, you know, just sitting there and receiving some information or whatever. But I think the reason this matters is because we are trying to translate into a language in a culture that is very much an attention economy. I mean, we just have so much information coming at us so fast that if you can't be engaging, or at least let people see that you can speak the language that they're familiar with, I think they check out pretty quickly.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think in a sermon, you have to wear four different hats. I think in each sermon, you've got to play four different parts. And I think the first one is like the entertainer, the ministainer is what I think the language I stole from Friends is, where you have to do stuff that's engaging. And you can see the nonverbals of people if you've gone on and you've put on – here are the four parts, by the way. The ministainer, the coach who gives you, come on, guys, you guys can do this. The Dr. Phil who gives you life application lessons, like, okay, these are the steps you can take to live this out. And then I think you have to also have to be the professor who knows the text, who can give you insight into what's going on in the text, what's going on in the background. But say you stay in the professor role too long. I can see people checking out, like their head starts to drop back down. But then if you come back in and you say something that's engaging, whether it's an interesting story or it's a joke or something, people's eyes look back up and you can see people reconnecting. Mm. Because it's just not weird. It's not normal for us to pay attention for 30 minutes to someone straight talking. And so I think you're right. I think you have to put the work into that. Now, when you were talking about the Jonah story earlier, Stormont, you were talking about the word glory, which you said means the word weighty.
Right.
Right? And so it's almost as if to communicate something that's really weighty, that has a lot of significance to it, sometimes you have to use Dickinson's language, you have to tell it on a slant.
Hmm.
And you have to come at it from the side, which I think that's what good comedy can do. Because if you get people laughing, you can say things that otherwise you would not have permission to say.
Yeah, I like the way Chris Rock says it. He says people will listen to you when they're laughing, and mm-hmm. That they won't listen when they're not. You can say the harder things. You can take them to the places where they're afraid of, mm-hmm. and make them be able to laugh about it. And so I think that's right. I think that's the way Jonah worked, because it was this ridiculously funny story. But humor's all throughout the Bible. Unfortunately, we're just not in the culture that it was originally written in, so we miss a lot of that.
Well, one of the things that is definitely a consistent with both preachers and with comedians is that it just takes a lot of work to do this. And if you listen to any comedian talk about their craft, you realize that they put a whole lot of work into it, that when they get up to perform, it looks like they're talking just carefree.
Mm.
But the way they do that is from a lot of preparation.
One of the things I tell the young preachers who I work with, and I've told this to probably every single one of them at different times, it's a comedian story. Jeff Foxworthy heard Bill Engvall talk, you know, do a set at a club, and afterward he came up to him and he said, you went on way past your punchline. You told the funniest part of a story and then you kept going. And I heard that, you know, 7 years ago, and I realized that's exactly what I do. And so I tell a lot of young people who are wanting to be preachers, you know, your story, you had a great story, your punchline went, and then you kept going, and you should have just dropped it and gone on. And the reason I'm answering your question with that is because the word craft on stories and humor and all that, that's an apt word, because it is a – telling a story is an art form. And that's what Jesus – I mean, Jesus was phenomenal at this. I think Jesus was funny, but he was so good at telling a story, and I think the people who are talking on behalf of Jesus should take notes on that.
Yeah.
I think, too, though, there is something about – the audiences that the comedians perform in front of help them write their act over mm-hmm. time. And because they, like you say, they pay attention, we pay attention. Did people listen at this point? Did anyone lean forward? Was there a laugh? There wasn't. They can help you find the best parts of a story. They can help you find the most meaningful parts of a sermon. And I think that's the other part of it is comedians are always paying attention to how the audience is receiving their material.
That's right.
And even if a joke bombs, while that is not what they wanted, that tells them something important that they can take back with them when they rewrite their act. And I know I've done this. I've heard other preachers do it. You can tell the sermon was written in their office, and even though they're standing on a stage delivering it to a group of people, they're delivering it in their office. Mm-hmm. They did not write it with anybody in mind, and they're not preaching it in conversation with a group of people who are actually listening. They're just reading what's on the page. Even if they're not using notes, they're just going forward and reading what's on the page. So, but I love watching really skillful comedians who, even in their act that is well-timed and well-written, sometimes you can see they start shifting and responding to the audience in a way that makes the thing come alive.
Yeah, that's right.
What does that look like to shift and contour your message to the audience as you're preaching?
If I'm telling a story or if I'm making a point and I can tell that everybody's checking out or looks of confusion, then I can either say, okay, I'm going to let you be confused about that, or I could pause and take another run at it based on facial expressions to say, I better explain that a bit more.
Yeah.
Sometimes in some traditions, you have churches that'll talk back to you. Mm-hmm. You have people that'll say something. And that is always dangerous and fun at the same time. But every now and then somebody will say something that can launch you off onto something even more important. I don't know if this is completely true, but I've been told in the more charismatic preaching traditions that a lot of those guys, when they get up and start preaching, they barely know what they're going to talk about. They've got four or five things that could work, and they start running through them, and when they land on something that the church responds to, whether it's clapping, hallelujah, jump up and shout, mm-hmm. they park on it. And that might determine what they do for the rest of the sermon, because obviously that was the point that church needed to hear. And then they just go.
You know, the people that I've enjoyed hearing their preaching and wanted to be like were people who broke that fifth wall, who it wasn't, you know, that they responded when people laughed when they weren't supposed to,
mm-hmm. yeah,
or didn't laugh when they were. They responded to, and there's a danger to this, right? I mean, I remember one time I was speaking at a youth rally in Memphis, and I had absolutely no relationship with these people. You know, I was working in Texas at the time, but I was in Memphis, and somebody's cell phone went off, and I was like, here, give it to me. Let me say hi. And I lost them. I mean, for the next 20 minutes, they were like, yeah, I know, right? Like, I thought it'd be funny, and it turned out I was being a bully and just a jerk to whoever forgot to turn their cell phone off. And so, I mean, there's a risk to this kind of thing, this is one of the benefits that ministers have with being in a church for a while, because I feel like they'll give you the benefit of the doubt afterwards. If you've been in the hospital rooms, if you've been, you know, at funerals and, you know, having lunch and coffee with the people that you're sharing life with, then when you do something a little edgy or it could be seen a couple of different ways, they might give you the most generous explanation for why you're doing it. And they may laugh. And especially if you make fun of yourself, which is something I think preachers do and should do. Self-effacing humor is, in my experience, the best kind of way to break the ice and get people's defenses down to talk about what you're wanting to talk about.
Yeah.
You're really good at that too, Stormit.
No, I'm not. You go.
You make fun of yourself really well. So well, in fact, I've started making fun of you when I preach.
Yeah.
And my church loves it too.
There's lots of material. You'll have lots of material to work with.
Yeah. Okay, so you talked about when people in your congregation are on your side, which is clearly something that stand-up comedians do not have. It's a benefit of being a preacher. But what comedians also don't have are people who have long-standing animosity towards you within your church. Now, I know both of you could not relate to that from firsthand experience, but can you imagine what maybe other preachers are like when you're having to preach in front of an audience that is hostile towards you? What is that experience like?
I know I've had the experience where, and it's not always somebody I know, but sometimes it is, that I can just tell they're not enjoying the sermon.
Yeah.
They don't like what I'm talking about. They're mad at me, or they've got their arms crossed. And there, sometimes I take that as a challenge. I'm gonna break the shell, and I'm gonna see if I can't get this person to laugh or at least uncross those arms. And sometimes I just ignore it.
Yeah, you know, I've been pretty blessed with having churches that are I've always since for the most part are for me. But there's always going to be when you talk about things that are when you talk about things like who God is, it touches something so deep inside of people, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing. And so a lot of times preachers can be the scapegoat, and you know, I've said things in the middle of sermons that made almost everybody cross their arms before, and it wasn't intentional. You know, 9 times out of 10, you know, spontaneous stuff that comes to mind I think works for me. But that 1 out of 10, when it doesn't, it's so bad. I mean, I remember one time I did a joke, and I'm pretty apolitical. I mean, you guys are my friends. You know that I'm not a super political person. But one time I did a there was something that I was talking about, a story. Oh, Caesar's propaganda was to misinform and get everybody confused. And it popped in my mind, and I said it, and I thought it was a great idea, which is the mission statement of Fox News. Ha, 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 ha. And it was ice cold to the best. And it was on me. That was just a stupid thing to do. And trying to create a community of reconciliation to basically say this one group, you know, whoever thinks this certain way, you're basically idiots and Caesar worshipers or whatever. Yeah. That's the edge and offense of comedy. You know, Randy Harris talks about how every humor always is going to offend or pick on somebody. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of it, and that's why it works. And so is it worth it? And I tell my young preacher people, you know, I think that's why self-effacing humor needs to be your go-to, because it also helps people know that you're maybe safe. Mm-hmm. I in college, I was in a room one time where one of my now really good friends was being made fun of, and they had plenty of material to make fun of him. And I remember thinking, if anybody's going to get made fun of in this room, it's going to be me. And so I started saying, you think that's bad? And then talking about me. And this guy wasn't even my friend at the time. And I'm not a saint, and there's lots of times that I wish I would have done that I haven't. But it actually worked the exact opposite. You know, I thought what I was going to do is be less cool for doing that. Mm-hmm. But I found myself, you know, people would laugh, but then they would come talk to me later about stuff. And I think on a macro scale, that's what happens in sermons when you use humor, that you're not picking on people other than like elders. You can always, you know,
pick on elders.
That's right. I've noticed that when something hasn't worked for me, if I've tried to tell a joke and it hasn't worked, if I go back and try to figure out why it didn't work, it's almost always because I somehow was making fun of people in the room. I was asking the audience to laugh at themselves. Mm-hmm. And they weren't ready for it. They will laugh at me, and they will laugh at a third party. They will laugh at the devil, if you will.
Yeah.
So that they will laugh at the elders in that generic form. They will laugh at the guy who was serving you your hamburger at the restaurant the other night, but they're not necessarily going to laugh at themselves. And I bet you 90% of my bombed jokes have been when I've somehow ended up making fun of the audience, and I'm asking them to laugh at themselves as I'm making fun of them, and it almost never works.
Mm. You know, like Chris Rock says that, as he says, he tries to talk about what people do and not who they are. I like that. Yeah. I think that's a good distinction.
Right. Well, and you can talk about they will make the connection. If I'm talking about my uncle who's crazy and does crazy stuff, they will say, I've got an uncle just like that, or I'm doing the exact same stuff he's talking about his uncle doing. And they will make that leap and they will laugh at themselves while they're laughing at your uncle. They just don't want to laugh at themselves while laughing at themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons it seems like people love a comedian who in some way is dysfunctional. Because when you have a dysfunctional comedian or a comedian who puts on a character of someone who's dysfunctional during their set, it gives them an easy target to laugh at. And so there's always this perception that a lot of comedians are dysfunctional people. Sinbad says the line that comedians are best when riding the bus. Okay, when they're at a tough spot in life, they're riding the bus. That's when their better stand-up happens. And if you saw on the comedian documentary that Seinfeld put out, he had a younger comedian whose story was also intertwined with Seinfeld's, and I'm trying to figure out what the connection was. But you have this guy named Arnie Adams who was like 29 years old at the time, and he's just breaking into the business, which is the mirror opposite of Seinfeld, who, of course, was on the top, left his sitcom, and was just decided, hey, I'm going to do some more stand-up. But Arnie Adams just got his first break. He went to a festival, did well there, went on Letterman, did well. But if you've seen the documentary, this Arnie Adams guy seems like this arrogant, entitled, miserable person. Like he's given this word by some older comic that he needs to just let his set do the talking. But the guy walks out of the room and says, oh, he's a jerk, or he said something similar to that. And he comes across as a guy who feels just like really entitled. He knows what's going on. And he's just seen as this, you know, this miserable person who can't find joy in anything that he does. But he's a comedian who's doing really well. And so it's like, do you have to in some way be an insufferable person to be a good comedian? Now, I know you can't make the translation and say, well, do you need to be an insufferable person to be a good preacher? No one's going to say, yeah, well, I need to be a spiritually unhealthy person to be a good preacher. But do you think there's part of that, like working out of your deficiencies, out of your own idiosyncrasies, that helps you actually preach better?
I think there's a fine line. I was talking to somebody the other day about the line between wanting to please people or preaching for approval and needing affirmation to feel good about yourself versus I don't want to deliver a bad sermon. I don't want to go home feeling like I didn't give my best. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to put in extra work because I want to be a good preacher. And yeah, I get more affirmation when that happens, but I also know there have been a few times where I thought I just didn't quite go the extra mile with that message. And I don't know if anybody else in the room noticed it, but I did. I felt it. And I hate those Sunday afternoons when I feel that way. So there's part of me, I work a little harder on my sermons to avoid that feeling of I didn't give everything than
yep.
Then maybe I should sometimes.
I think Spurgeon's line about never preach to save your soul is probably a big difference between the story you just told about the young comedian and what I think a preacher should be doing. But I think the temptations are the same. If I need a church or an audience to justify my existence, then that may make me work hard and preach well, but it would probably go against the very thing that I'm called to do, which is I don't think my job, even though I love this calling, is primarily who I am as I stand before God.
Yeah.
And I think what Wade just said, I think that's exactly right. I have great joy in getting to preach. I love it. I love doing what I get to do. I love writing sermons. I love preaching sermons. I love hanging out with people afterwards. I love talking about sermons. I love talking to preachers. I mean, I love every part of this job. But I think the distinction there is I love this because I have this sense of getting to partner with God, not being, you know, kind of the angry older brother in the prodigal son story standing outside the party being like, all these years I've been slaving. Because I think that's where that leads. I think ultimately if you need church or your ministry to justify your existence, then ultimately you're going to be squeezing stuff out of that church.
Yep.
And you'll become resentful. Mm-hmm. And you won't be helpful to them.
No, I think you're 100% right. I think if you're a person who likes people telling you how great you are, then there's nothing better than being a young baby preacher. Mm-hmm. Like, because when you're a young boy, everyone loves a baby preacher. So when you're that 20-year-old kid who comes home and preaches at your home church, or you're a young kid and you're preaching, everyone wants to tell you how great it is what you're doing, or how great your sermon is, or they're going to say, you know, one day you're going to be a great preacher, because there's just something about being a young preacher that everyone likes to tell you how great you are.
Right.
But if you let that carry into your life, like you're saying, that is a black hole. Pete Holmes is a comedian who's now doing a show after Conan on TBS. He said this, that the better you're doing at knowing yourself is when you're doing better stand-up.
Huh.
You do better stand-up when you know yourself better. And I think that's 100% right. When you can act out of a sense of fullness and understanding of yourself, I think you're going to say better things because it's coming out of a better place. Now, with that being said, I still think you have to be a different kind of person to be a preacher. Seinfeld in the show Comedian tells a story from Glenn Miller, tells a joke about this band who's flying to do some show late in the winter, and the airstrip where they're going to land is snowy and icy, so they have to land somewhere else just a few miles down the road. And so they land on this airstrip, and the band, while they're wearing their full regalia, have to walk through the snow, through the fields, to get to this place they're going. So they're walking in their suits, and they've got their instruments, and they walk by this house. And it's a snowy night, and the house is lit. It looks warm. There's a fire going. There's a family sitting around a dinner table. It's a very Rockwellian picture. And one of the musicians looks at the other person, goes, how can anyone live like that? You know, if you're a comedian, you kind of live differently. To be a preacher, you have to be wired somewhat differently, don't you think?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the greatest benefits of being a preacher is that when awful stuff happens to you, your first thought isn't, oh, this is awful. Your first thought is going to be, this is going to be a great story.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. As a preacher, you can have something bad happen to you, and you know, I get 2 minutes worth of material.
That's right. That's right.
It's just a different wiring. Okay. So one last thing. One of the things you see with Seinfeld is he has this line after he gets done doing his act. He says, it's never good enough. And you go, man, if Seinfeld is saying that, he says it's never good enough. Elsewhere, he says, you know, I was on stage and I didn't have confidence. I felt like I was wearing my father's suit. The arms are too long, it's too baggy, and I didn't feel confident. If you see Seinfeld who's struggling with confidence and struggling like he didn't deliver, shouldn't that make you feel a little better about yourself? Because don't we all end up feeling that way after sermons?
Yeah. Sometimes. I don't always have that it's never good enough feeling. Part of it is because, again, I know I'm not going to have to preach a sermon again. I don't have to redo it. But I don't know. There are times when I go home and feel like I did what I wanted to do today. It wasn't, I'm not going to sweat over they didn't laugh at every joke or I didn't remember to say everything I wanted to say, but it seemed like what I wanted to have happened, the connection I wanted to make, that connection was made. Wasn't a home run, but I wasn't swinging for one. I was swinging for a base hit, and I got on base today. And when I was younger, I remember just being tortured in all day long on a Sunday afternoon, no matter what happened, if I didn't feel like I had preached the perfect sermon, whatever that was. And I don't know. I feel like over the last few years, I've cut myself some more slack to say, it wasn't perfect, but it never had to be perfect to do what I wanted to do. And I'm not going to let it ruin the rest of my Sunday because it wasn't perfect. And that's sure a lot easier and a lot better way to live. At least it is for me. And I think it's more faithful to the identity we're trying to cultivate as preachers.
Yeah, and you know, I think this gets at the heart of the difference between these two callings, because I've noticed, and maybe this is just me, but I've noticed that every time I finish a sermon, every single time, I'm always just a little bit like, well, I immediately focus on the things that didn't happen the way I wanted to, or the things that I forgot to say, or, I mean, it's rarely that I feel like it's perfect, but I've noticed there is almost a direct correlation between the sermons that I don't feel good about and the sermons that I get feedback from people on saying that it helped them, it blessed them somehow. And this is the point I'd like to leave you with, Luke. There's a gap between what we do, what we say, and what people hear. And I think this is where this calling is a partnership with God, because what we hope is that God fills that gap. And so all that disappointment, or it's just, it wasn't perfect, it wasn't done just the right way, may just leave a little bit more room for God. Now, I don't want to presume that and be lazy and not work ahead of time, but I've learned to kind of reframe that disappointment in a way of, well, I wonder what God will do with this.
Yeah, that's true. I definitely, that's a good picture to always keep in mind, is that whatever we do, we're ultimately bringing, you know, our couple loaves and our couple fish and putting it before God, and God somehow makes something miraculous happen when you have one broken person communicating a beautiful message that changes lives.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you having the time to come on the show, and we hope to hear from you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Luke.
Thanks, Luke.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.